Okay, so starting a new unit on communication. So this is sort of then wraps up the kind of four fundamental chapters before the midterm, before we go into the little bit more specific things, where we'll start seeing some of the topics that were brought up in these four chapters being applied in more complex ways in the rest of the chapters in the semester after the midterm. So just a reminder of the timeline going forward here. So ARED is out in perusal in the reading. I still have to finish UCED to make sure I hit the points that I'm covering in this unit, but those aren't due this Sunday. They're due next Sunday. The timeline here is that we have today, the beginning of the communication unit, Thursday. Next week, Tuesday, will be the end of the communication unit. And then we'll have a midterm review Thursday of next week, where basically, just if there's questions, we'll handle questions. But if there aren't questions, or if there we need to sort of encourage questions, then I've got sort of a highlights reel of slides that I think are important from each of the individual lectures that we can go through. And if that generates questions, then great. And so I've tried to put those highlights for each individual unit under the unit study guides for A, B, and C. And so as I'm working through D, then that will go up there. And basically, that highlights reel that I'll have in lecture F will just be the combination of all of those. So that's what we'll go on Thursday then of next week. And then the week after that, which I believe is October 8th and the 10th, and I now have definitely got that on the Canvas calendar. Those are stage one and stage two. So you are welcome to come here. I will be here during those 2 days, October 8th and 10th, during this time slot. If you want to bring a laptop to work on that online exam in here in a quiet space for stage one, that's fine, but otherwise you'll have the whole day. So whenever you start it, you'll get 90 minutes. So I can hang out a little bit longer than our normal 75 because it doesn't look like there's anything in here afterwards unless there's some special event. So barring some special event on that Tuesday, I'm willing to stay in here for the full 90 if anybody wants to take it here. Otherwise, if nobody shows up within the first 15 minutes, I'll probably leave here for that Tuesday. So that will be individual. You'll get one sheet, double-sided, of hand-produced. So that can be digital, that can be, written down on a notepad, that can be typed. I just don't want screen captures of any material. So you can draw your own diagrams, you can type things up, you can sketch things out. That's fine, but I want you to manually do it, to go through that process of building that sheet for you. And you can use that, but that's all you can use on that stage one. But then stage two, you're not going to get your scores for stage one. You're not going to find out the right answers for stage one. But then in stage two, then you'll get all day that day. It will not be timed, and you'll be able to submit the exact same exam again, but you'll be able to work with anybody else in the class. You'll have access to your notes, access to Canvas, access to the textbook, and then you'll submit that. And then 80% of your score will be your stage one score, 20% of your score will be your group score. Yeah. It's the exact same exam, except stage two is not timed. You get all day. Stage one, whenever you start it, you get 90 minutes. And you can use your notes on stage two, just not on stage one. So, yep, you can use all your notes. You can use your textbook. You can talk to other people in the class. You can come here during that time period and form groups and, and just work things out together. I'll be here just kind of taking care of the room, but it's not like I'm going to be preventing you from talking to each other. Like, if you come here, then you feel free to use this as an area to meet. You can use for stage two, you can use Discord, you can use Slack, whatever you'd like, as long as you're only working with people enrolled in the course this semester. Is there another question? You don't get your scores. I may, if I have time, be able to give you an aggregate. Like, I can say, just so you know, 20% of the class didn't do very well on question four. I might be able to tell you that, but I won't be able to tell you exactly which 20, got it right or whatever. Now, in the past, when I've done that, Sometimes when I do that, I notice interesting strategies. Like people will get in a group of 10. Like I'll be sitting here in stage two, and it's just kind of cool to listen to you guys like work things through. And there'll be like a group of 10 people, and they'll like survey and they'll say, 20% of us chose this answer. And he said 20% of the class got it right. So like we just did a little sampling exercise there. So we'll choose that one or something. And so that's the sort of like gaming that I didn't ever intend. And yet, I still tried to give you, if I can, a little bit of information so you know where to direct your efforts. Yeah. So you'll basically take, I mean, they're just weighted on Canvas so that, like, I forget, let's say this whole exam's 20%. Then 16% will be stage one and 4% will be stage two. I mean, I've never given an exam in this class before. This is the first time I've ever taught animal behavior. So I don't have any stats. I'm building this exam right now. So yeah, I don't, it's not my goal. I'm not one of those faculty who says like the average should be a C. If everybody gets, 95, that's fine. So I'm not trying to make it hard for anybody, but I just am trying to do a fair assessment of the learning outcomes from the four units. Yep. Yeah, that's a piece of paper. It could be a printout, but yeah, front and back, so double-sided. Again, it could be typed. That's fine. Yep. Well, I'm not gonna. So the goal of the concept assign the concept exercises there is a little different than the goal of the exam. So I don't plan on copying a lot of those questions. So it'll be in a little bit more of an applied feel on the midterm. But I do think that looking back through how you did on those is a good idea. The big thing is, I built those little study guides that said like by the end of this unit you should know how to A, B, C, D. Those are the things that when I'm looking for questions, I basically put that, like I have my Canvas up on this side where I'm building the exam, and I have those up on this side. And I say, okay, how am I going to assess this learning outcome? And then I come up with a question. So those are the things I would recommend you sort of focus on. Any other questions? Yep. Oh yeah, the comprehensive study guide will just be a link to all of those four study guides. Yep. Anything else? Okay, great. All right, so let's play communication or not. So first example here, this is this Bornean rock frog. And notice it's got its legs stuck up in the air here and all its toes splayed out. And it's got, the white showing here. So this, I'm going to go forward and show you some videos here. These videos are slowed down. So because of camera effects, there's a little bit of a flashing. And so hopefully it won't be too bad, but this won't go that long. So you can see this in slow motion in the field here. It just sticks out its leg. And then in the lab, we'll see this over here. I'll go to the next one there. Similar behavior in the lab. So when you look at this, like we're going to go through about four examples here, and I want you to in each one of them sort of think like, do I is my gut tells me that's communication, and if so, why? So how many? I mean, like, so what are your thoughts? Like, does anybody think this is communication or just something else? Yeah. Okay, so maybe it's like a physiological stretch. It certainly looks like it's stretching. We see it a lot though. So, there's this image of this frog in the wild. There's this one in the wild, this one in the lab. Three different frogs all seem to be doing that same behavior. So, any other just reflections or thoughts? Yeah. So it sounds like you're saying it could be communication, but it's like communication to a predator to make yourself look bigger. So in that case, but so what made you feel like it was communication and not just some other physiological function? Okay. So you're saying it's a weird way to sit. You're saying it's kind of you said when they sit normally, they're less exposed, but when they're doing this, it's. Sure. So it doesn't seem like the safest behavior to do if it's just your everyday behavior. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. All right. So blue-footed boobies. If you've never seen a blue-footed booby, you should look them up. They're it's a bird that has blue feet, and they wave the feet around, and so that it seems past experience sort of familiar with other ways that animals have communicated that this. Well, let's see a couple of other sorts of examples here. So, human examples here. So this is an article from, interestingly enough, the journal Cognition. Although I'm not really sure there's a lot of cognitive stuff going on in this article, but in this article they basically showed a bunch of people videos of people walking around and ask them to make inferences about different traits of those people just based on their walk. And they found that the personality traits, that the personality traits here, attribution, was actually pretty good based on gait cues. So gaits gave away some reliable judgments on these traits. And so there's information that people are getting off the gait of individuals. So would we call the gait of individuals, people just walking around, you looking at them and saying, oh, based on the way you walk, I'm making this assessment of your personality. And it turns out it's reliable. Based on the way you walk, I make another assessment that turns out it's reliable. So would we call those gait cues communication? Gesundheit. Any thoughts about that? Does that seem, yeah. So you say, so you, so that, I guess how you're saying, since you did language, you said you would be communication, that you're trying to that communicate or whatever. Yeah. Okay. So in that example, she said, well, what if, imagine hypothetically speaking, someone's storming off, then you'd said, I don't want anything to do with that person. What if someone's just limping? Is limping communication? What was that? Why do you say no? You said, say that with your foot hurts. Right. So you're saying that since your foot hurts, and so in that case, you're just stuck with the limp. So maybe the limping isn't communication there. Yep. Okay. So, okay. Okay, based on sort of things that would happen after, people that ask you about your limp and so on. Yeah. You're saying that you think the limp is, or yeah, I think that's what you were saying, that is a form of communication, right? Right. So, but that's because you were saying that you imagined that someone with a limp might then someone ask, oh, is your foot hurting you? Can I help you? Can I open the door for you? Those sorts of things. Can I get a chair for you? And so on. So you're saying in that case that was beneficial to you, that because you showed that you had this sign of an injury, that they were getting out of your way? Is that the what you're sort of saying? Okay. It sounds like in both of those answers, you're saying that the limp could bring about, through some mechanism, through some cultural mechanism, a response that could bring upon a benefit to the person doing the limping. Yeah. Okay. So there was a comment here about a handicap principle. Maybe it's giving off useful information. It sounds like you're sort of suggesting to the receiver about the individual. Doesn't necessarily benefit the individual, but it does benefit somehow someone else in the group. All right, let's put a pin in that for a second, and because we'll have more opportunities here. So here's a funny word. I think it's how do I always borborygmus, which is stomach rumbling. So stomach rumbling is it's a very conspicuous sign of gastrointestinal health. Is it communication? Would you say stomach rumbling is communication? Yeah. Okay. Interesting. Communicating to yourself. So, if you didn't have the internal cues, maybe you at least had this external cue that, whoa, that was loud. Maybe I should do something about that. That's interesting. And this question of intention is also sort of interesting. It's hard to know, like, when do you intend to do something or not, especially like if you're talking about C. elegans, a worm, a nematode, a worm, if it does something that shares information, do we have to know what it intends in order to know whether it was communication or not? Something, yeah, anyways, yep. Yeah. Okay, so so it sounds like we're sort of converging on this in some of these comments, this idea that anything that provides information, where information, and we may talk about this a little bit more next week, but information is something that reduces certainty or uncertainty in the environment. I don't know what my hunger state is. Oh, I heard I must be hungry. So now I know more about my internal state. And so we have to sort of say, is that enough? To just simply have information. So, and this interesting thing about communicating to yourself, that was, food for thought, so to speak, is that, can you communicate with yourself through these weird external feedback loops? Something I do think we should think about. All right, so Last example here. This is termite headbanging. So these are three different species of termite. I've got videos here of two of them. And so these are termites that you would find either all over the US or on the East Coast of the US, definitely like converged on like Florida. Somebody like this one actually originally came from Taiwan, and so it's all over, very destructive and all that. But then there's these Macrotermes that are in Africa that build these giant mounds that have these structures here, and here's what one of the soldiers of those guys. So these are types of termites that there's a particular there's different types of workers, and they're one of these types of workers has these really hard cuticles. They're all soldiers, and they also have these mandibles that are a little bit sharper, and so they look a little bit different than workers. I think over here you've got both a combination of workers and soldiers, but they build these giant mounds here. And if you were to come and a big mammal were to come through and break one of these mounds, then you would see this sort of behavior happen with the soldiers, which we'll see here. And I don't know if the sound on this is probably not gonna play, and it's not that important if it does, but because I think the visual will be large enough. But if you see this termite here, notice this soldier's head is just this is I think in real time. So this is I don't know, it's something like a couple of meters per second is the speed of this. And as it hits against the side of this, it makes a loud noise, a noise that you actually can hear. In fact, people who are exterminators actually will look for termites by listening for these sounds and of these soldiers. And so I'll show you, that's in this species over here. This is in real time, these reticular termites here. You can see them. It's almost hard to see when they snap their little heads there. And if I go over to this slow version, this is super slowed down. And so you can see the head here is going up and then coming down, whap, and doing that over and over again. So this headbanging, what happens is the soldiers will go and do that against the substrate. And when one soldier starts to do it, a bunch of other soldiers start to do it, and the workers go elsewhere. And so you end up hearing this. The workers go where it's, safer, and there's only these soldiers around with their little bit of defenses that hang around in the area, and they all do this headbanging. So is this communication? Any thoughts? Or is this just something else? Is this just termites moving around? Do you think it looks different than termites just moving around? Nobody. Yeah.
Excuse me.
Okay, so I've seen this pattern before, you're saying, in others that we would call communication, this idea of this spreading message is going through here. As opposed to just, it doesn't, I mean, I'm hoping you see, like, it doesn't look like if we see the other workers that are walking around, there's very few. Well, if you look closely, there's a worker out here that is going back and forth, and that's actually this weird body shaking thing that is used in other contexts, which doesn't occur. Which occurs even when they're not getting, like in this case, they're snaking a camera down into this. In this case, it's a tree, and they're seeing, or they're a piece of damp wood that's on the ground, and then they're seeing what they look like. And this is how the soldiers are responding to this, this camera that is in there. But there's other behaviors that are always going on even without, this invasion. So there's a particular a time that this headbanging goes on, and it, I think, looks very different. So, anyways, what I just want you to think about these things, about those four examples. Yeah. No, just No, I'm not. This isn't a natural history course, so if it's more about the fundamentals of the behaviors here, and so I'm not expecting you to memorize that, you know, termites do this, or if there are any special examples like that, I'll make that pretty clear. But we're using biodiversity to try to expose to these different fundamental ideas in behavior, and in this case, communication. No, but hopefully they're helpful. So when we look at these four examples and others, we have to sort of think about, like, you know, what are the salient features of communication relative to just the presence of information? Because there's information everywhere in the environment. And we could just say that anything that is informative is communication. But is that useful for us? Because is that maybe too big of an umbrella? Does that cover too many things? Does that tell us about, I mean, there's if your stomach rumbles and someone else hears it, that is information that they can use, but does that tell you about anything about the evolution of the rumbling of the stomach? And so it seems to animal behaviorists that there are certain types of information passing that have been shaped just for information passing. And there are other types of information that are just natural byproducts of living life. And communication is a term we use for those things that have been shaped just for information passing. So with that, you know, we have these certain terms that we use. So one of them that's an important term is cue. A cue is just perceivable information or a percept that potentially can reduce a receiver's uncertainty. So those things that everybody's saying that, like, oh, it feels like if I'm getting information and I can respond to it in a way that's beneficial to me, then at a minimum, that is a cue. So cues are really important. We say, like, what are informative cues in the environment? And those are things that receivers of those cues can then take advantage of. So we definitely need to know about cues. But there's something that is not quite there yet for us to sort of call it communication in a formal way. In order for us to call it communication in the way in which we talk about it in animal behavior, is that we have to talk about the transmission of signals from sender to receiver. Okay, so what's a signal? A signal is any act or structure, and I'll show you what I mean by act or structure in a second, that has evolved to carry a message from sender to receiver. And this is a really important thing that provides a benefit to both, not just one. So if it's a cue that is informative about a sender, but that sender actually doesn't receive a benefit from a receiver acting on it, we wouldn't refer to that as a signal. We wouldn't refer to that as communication. We refer to that as sort of exploitation of the cue by the receiver. So signals are something that is special, and that because they provide a fitness benefit to the sender and the receiver, we actually expect that behavior, that act or structure, to start to get shaped over time. Those acts or structures that are better at providing this fitness benefit to both will end up being better proportioned in the environment. There'll be more of them in the environment. And that's how we'll get things that are shaped just for information passing and not byproducts of just physiology. That's where we're going to sort of see examples here. Now, you can have communication with yourself. And so the stomach example, it's hard to know if that's really communication with yourself or just a physiological byproduct. Because if your stomach's rumbling, you probably have, you know, things going up your vagus nerve that are triggering hunger and stuff like that too. You know, other examples, common examples are like echolocation. So in echolocation, you've got this, you know, this piercing sound that is not just a byproduct of breathing. That it goes out and then it bounces off things and comes back. And the way in which it comes back gives you information. So it's actually a benefit to you as the sender and the receiver. And so another example of that is pheromone trail laying. If an ant isn't using it for communication, so if the only way you can get back home is by laying a trail and then following that trail back, like Hansel and Gretel and breadcrumbs, then in that case, we refer to that as auto communication. But at the instant at which other ants start using that trail too, then it may not be auto communication. And so auto communication is kind of a rare thing, but it is possible for signals to evolve to work to the whose sender and receiver are the same individual. So we're going to see examples of that, but are there any basic questions right now about these definitions? Yeah. They can be the same, and in the case of auto communication, they usually aren't. Yeah. Yes. So that's the key difference between a signal and a cue, is that it is a benefit to both parties, sender and receiver. Question? Okay. So if the injured prey, so you mean like if it's like limping because it's injured? So that's a great question. The general question is basically how do we know where the benefits and costs are? But you know, in that case of like a squirrel, I'll go back to the human example. We ask, is limping a signal? That's now we can use those terms. Is limping a signal or limping a cue? If by limping, by maybe leaning into my limp, you know, so that it's particularly strong. If that causes people to treat me differently in a way in which I get through my day a little better, and then it's getting towards the signal. But then you say, well, that what benefit do they get out of receiving it? And so that becomes kind of a more complicated sort of question there. Similar to in the squirrel case, you know, that the there can be a cue of that the squirrel is hurt, and that is most likely a liability to that squirrel because it might be targeted by a predator that knows that it doesn't have to, you know, it's probably going to be able to catch that squirrel but not the other ones. But if there's some weird social benefit to that squirrel limping, but again, it would have to be like, you know, like me talking right now, there are words coming out of my mouth that have nothing to do with my breath. These sounds that I make are purely here to share information with others. And the fact that you are still here and you haven't walked out suggests that there is some marginal benefit of you being here. And so, and there is some benefit to me being here because I'm employed by this university. So that's an example of like, in order for me to do this job that supposedly is good for both of us, then I have to make these sounds, which are not sounds that I would make if I was just living a solitary life of a mud daub or wasp or something like that. And so that's an example of it's a function that is not just a side effect of your physiology. It has actually been, and we're going to learn about this term here in a second, ritualized. It's been stereotyped to be something like that frog, when it puts its leg out there, that is not something it needs to do for any other purpose but for signaling. And so, and it does that because there's some benefit it gets from the receiver seeing its white hand out there, and then the receiver receives some benefit from seeing it. He, you know, so both get the benefit, and that's the reason why the receiver has learned to, or has not learned, but has evolved to pay attention to that, and the sender has evolved to give that signal. So usually things like limping, it's hard for us to bin those into the signal category. They're usually into the cue category in some way. So you can somehow exploit others by generating a cue. And that's what we're going to get into in the third part of this, the dishonest signaling. Like, how can you exploit others by sending, you know, signals that aren't actually signals? All right. This will become a little bit more. Actually, yeah, sorry. Absolutely. So the question was, can there be a signal whose has an intended receiver that benefits, but is a cue to a predator? And that's what we're going to close with, is the example of eavesdropping, where if you have to broadcast signals, there is a liability that others will hear them, and they may benefit in a way that actually costs you. And an example of that that I'll talk about at the end is try finding a male cricket that has started chirping in your house. So it chirps because it's trying to attract a mate, but it's also attracting you. And because it knows that if you find it, that's really bad for it, the instant it gets the hint that someone's onto it, it stops chirping. And so we'll talk about concealment as a way to mitigate these risks. But without that concealment, then that cricket's super loud and you would find it. And then, of course, you would just take it outside and let it free, right? So that's exactly the sort of thing we're talking about there. So we'll get to that. All right, so let's get a couple of these things where I think it'll become a little more clear as we get some of these examples down. So I talked about act or structure. So this canyon wren here has this particular speckling on its back. We refer to that as a signal. It's always emitted, it is developmentally chosen there. These patterns could be just identifying marks, like I am a male of this species. Or it might be that the only way you can get the white spots is if you have been fortunate enough to find enough of a very rare nutrient in your environment, in which case that is an honest signal that you are, have such fantastic phenotypes that you can find that rare element. And so that's an example of a signal that is always on. And so we might call that a structure. But the call of the canyon wren is something that the canyon wren can sort of choose to turn on at any particular time, and it's very elaborate, and it signals to other canyon wrens, for example, that it's ready to mate, et cetera, et cetera. And so that's what we mean by an act. So signals can be things that we intend to turn on and turn off, or signals can be things that are just always there. Does that make sense? So to mean that how this is actually a signal, even though it's just a speckled pattern on the back of a bird? Okay. So we have to ask, how do these signals evolve? And so this sender receiver fitness is super, super important. So you just have to imagine that there are variations before the signal has evolved. There are informative cues between individuals in the population. And some of those cues are hidden for some individuals. They're just more subtle. And some of those cues are less subtle for other individuals. Those senders of those less subtle cues end up having those cues received by a receiver who responds to them in a particular way. And some receivers may have a visual system or a auditory system or whatever sensory system that is more tuned in to those cues than others. So you can also have variation on the receiver side. So if there is some benefit for the sender to send a signal that is received and responded to by the receiver, and if there's a benefit to the receiver as well, then what you're going to find is that those that are on the tail end of sending this cue that is more conspicuous, and those who are on the tail end of receiving this cue that is more conspicuous, are going to have greater reproductive success. And you will gradually get more receivers that have the ability to receive this cue and more senders that tend to send this cue. And that process will go on, and those that don't emit the cue will gradually be reduced in the population and possibly go away. And those with it might even get that cue elaborated further and further in this process of ritualization that we're about to sort of talk about here. So it's really important that there is at least a neutral benefit to one and a true benefit to the other, but usually there's a benefit to both. And it is that fitness benefit to both that causes changes in sensory systems and changes in the actions that emit these cues that gradually turn cues into signals that move them away from just a physiological accident to something that is specifically sharing information that improves outcomes for both sender and receiver. That's sort of the hint to this. And we have names for this process. So we have cues, which we've already talked about, and we have signals, which we talked about. And there is this process of co-option, so co-opting, or another term, exaptation, Stephen Jay Gould term, but they mean the same thing. And it's this process, and I want to emphasize this is through evolutionary history. This is not a learning process. So this is not like, over life history, you learn the signal. This ritualization is thought about over, natural selection is gradually shaping this over evolutionary history, and that's ritualization. And it's ritualization of the sender's attribute, like a cue, to form the basis of a signal that has meaning or importance to a receiver. That's ritualization. The sounds that I make now, there was, a proto-human that did not talk, did not make these sounds, but they had the makings of a voice box that could make sound. And gradually it became useful for grunts that naturally happened when you move around to turn into information channels. And when that happened, those who could grunt more on command did better than those who didn't. And gradually that turned into controlled grunting and what you hear today, my controlled grunting. So that's what we mean by ritualization. We lift it out of its physiological roots and into the information roots. And then, co-option or exaptation. So we're using something that was originally for something else, now being co-opted for this new purpose, in this case, for information sharing. Does that make sense what I mean by ritualization? Taking something that was just an accident and making the behavior all about it. Yeah. By an accident, I mean like, again, so like if I didn't have a voice box that allowed me to form these words, I still might, just due to breathing and things like that, if I stub my toe, I might make a sound that only happens when I stub my toe. Now, at that point, you might hear me make that sound that only accidentally happens when I stub my toe because it's, it's that breath or whatever. And you hearing that, if you happen to have a sensory system which notices that, then you might come over and help me and, you might prevent me from falling, for example. And then later, I might help you in some way because you helped me. And so now you receiving my grunt that only happens when I stub my toe has benefited both of us. And so over the whole population, those that are grunting louder whenever they stub their toes and those that are helping them end up benefiting more than those that are not. And in the next couple, many generations, then those grunts turn into more elaborate things that aren't just accidental physiological outcomes of the process of bumping into something. Okay. So cue ritualization, that's kind of how it all starts. And then, though, we have to fight noise. And so, noise is sort of any process that adds unwanted information that interferes with signals. So, for example, the sound of a flowing stream that makes it difficult for frogs to hear mating calls. Those frogs that I showed you that stick out their legs, called foot flagging or foot flashing behavior, they do that while they're vocalizing. Those frogs, there are very few frogs that do that. Those that do it are frogs that live by streams that are very, very loud. And so it is thought that those calls, which are partly for reproduction, partly for competition with other males, that foot flagging behavior is meant to assist in sharing a signal that otherwise would be corrupted by the noise of the flowing water. So noise leads to elaborations of signals that make them easier to hear in the noise. And one example of that is stereotypy. So it might be that every time I stub my toe, I make a slightly different tone, but over time, Then it starts being exactly the same tone. So when I stub my toe, it's a particular tone. When I stub, when I bump my elbow, it's another tone, and so on and so forth. And so if I take the variance out of the signal, then it makes it easier to cope with the variance added by the noise. And so that's, stereotyped behavior. That if every frog, if it sometimes put a leg out here, sometimes put a leg out here, sometimes put a leg out here, it would just look like it could just be stretching or whatever. But if every time a frog puts out its leg, it's like this weird behavior that you would never see a frog do over and over again, that's stereotyped behavior. That makes it much more obvious that that frog is signaling. And so that's what I mean by stereotypy. The other thing is redundancy, which is like merging two signals. So I'm not only speaking to you, but I'm also using my hands to try to communicate additional information. The frog is using its leg as well as vocalizing. Those two together make the call more salient. And those are two ways to fight noise. Okay. Yep. Yes, language, I would say, would be extreme stereotypy. So, like, that's like the words that I say, the word stereotypy. I keep saying it over and over again. Stereotypy, stereotypy. Like it sounds the same every time I say it. Now, if I said it funny every time, stereotypy or something like that, then you'd say, why did he say it that way? So the fact that I say it the same way over and over and over again makes it a more salient message. It has more meaning. It makes it easier to understand. So you have to learn my accent, you have to learn the way I say things, but once you get used to the way I say things, then it's easier for you to understand what I'm saying because I have a certain stereotyped way of talking. In general, so we'll see plenty of examples, especially next lecture, where we're going to go through different modalities and we'll see examples of like, honeybee waggle dances and things like that. So, like, if you don't know what a honeybee waggle dance is, well, I'll plan to show an example of it. But this is a behavior that is very clear that it is not just an insect walking around. Like, they walk in figure eights with very long, sort of connecting bars on the figure eights over and over again. And not only that, but they keep walking the same figure eight over and over again. And so that was what we refer to as sort of a very stereotyped signal, in that it is like you could not mistake that for just a bee walking around. Okay. Any other questions about that? All right. So redundancy, another example of this. So this is a flicker. Like you can see around here, I think this particular flicker is a little more north of here, but we've got our northern flickers as well. And flickers are types of woodpeckers, basically. And so they both drum, so by banging their beaks against things, but they also have colorful patterning. So they can combine these two signals together to make their mating signal much stronger. So visually, they can be evaluated by their patterning, and they also can be evaluated at the same time by the pounding that they make. Dogs, for example, a lot of people know the dogs urinate for scent marking, so that marks their territory. What they may not know is that when they kick, then there's actually glands in their feet that leave chemical marks on the ground. And there's thoughts that actually the scratches they make in the ground provide other visual signals to other dogs. And there's also hypotheses that other dogs in the vicinity at the time actually see this kicking and have some response to that. So that's an example of combining different types of chemical cues along with visual cues, the scratch marks and so on. So that's what we mean by redundancy, is like really want to make the mark clear. And so that's what they do that. So they combine these things together. All right. Yep. Sorry. Yep. That's an interesting question. So that's the redundancy that we're talking about. That is a interesting phenomenon But if this particular redundancy is sort of simultaneous redundancy. So, how do I at this instant get the message across to you given the noise? Now, if I were to say a pen and you were to say, I don't know what that is, a writing utensil, that would be an example of like, well, there is noise there. There's the uncertainty in the vocabulary that you have. And so I have different words that I can use to express that idea to you. So that is definitely related, but it's not usually when we talk about redundancy, we're thinking of like multimodality. Great. All right. And then we get back to our foot flagging, like I was talking about. And this particular type of signal that when it's coupled with, well, it doesn't matter when it's coupled. When animals signal by waving their limbs around, this was actually first kind of invented when it was discovered in frogs, but it's called a semaphore behavior. So, like those people at airports that are directing the planes around, those are called semaphores that are giving the signals. And I think this comes from nautical times. Well, they've sort of applied that here, where we're saying that when an animal uses their hands to wave to express a signal, we refer to that as a semaphore. And not only happens in this frog, as we saw, but there's oh right, and I forgot to find out this example here. And what's cool is that what they've shown in this frog is that if you give them testosterone, then they actually have an even stronger flagging behavior. So that's kind of what I'm saying up here is that male produced hormones, androgens, exaggerate an existing gesture, and the sensory system of the receiver already is tuned in to this white behavior. There's a predator that has this white on them that they're already looking to use. And so what this paper here talked about, and I'll sort of zoom in here, I think, on some of these things, is that they were sort of trying to understand physiologically how did this behavior evolve? And in this paper, they talk about how these frogs tend to like kick each other and when they get near each other, but they wanted to signal to other frogs, don't come near me, I'm going to kick you. And this existing hormonal pathway, when you inject them in the laboratory with more testosterone, you happen to create these very large kicks. And they know that this white that gets exposed when the leg is out very far happens to be the same signal that they know that other frogs are move away from when they see it in a predator. And so this is sort of a story that is related to this, oh, too far, this ritualization and stereotyping. So I guess I just into this message that I'm kind of saying back here is that originally this frog had a behavior, it kicked other frogs. There was a mechanism in which that kick could become exaggerated. Those frogs that happened to have a little bit more androgen in these competitive battles would have these large kicks that would expose a big scary white marker that the frogs were already conditioned to respond to. And that made their kicks even stronger signals to stay away. And that was good for both the sender and receiver because it prevented them from getting into these fights over territory. So that's an example of how a physiological mechanism can lead to ritualization, stereotypy, and this weird behavior that really just was a modified kick. And there was sort of a similar story with this poor Panamanian golden frog. It does another type of semaphoring behavior with its front legs. And so this is interestingly enough, these frogs do live by streams. They don't have a what we call an ear. They don't have a tympanic membrane. They can hear low frequency pulse things, but they can't hear a lot of other things. So when they're in this riparian or these river environments, it's very difficult for them to hear complex vocalizations. And so they couple vocalizations with this little bit flagging behavior here. And it's the same sort of thing. And they talk about in this paper that that this is that they have evidence that this is a modified walking behavior. So that they basically, as the frog walks, this behavior is just a stereotyped step that it makes in place that seems to now be used to couple with a little bit of vocalization to make it more clear. And I also bring this one up because it's kind of a famous example, and I left the Maryland Zoo in there because these frogs that used to be in Panama just got decimated by a fungal infection that really it affects a lot of amphibians, but it particularly affected them. So there was a huge effort to go down and collect basically every single one of these frogs from Panama. And now the only populations of these frogs you can find are in zoos, in captive breeding programs. But they have been succeeding in breeding this, and they're almost to the point where they can start releasing them back out into the world. So they're doing very well in captivity, but that was an example where, if it wasn't for actually taking them into captivity, we would have lost this little cute flagging frog. Anyways, so that is that. And this is just sort of elaboration of standard stepping motion, ritualization, and stereotyping. That is supposedly how we get signals. That is our theory. So, with that, do you have a semaphore for me? Do you have any questions? Is that clear what I mean by semaphores, ritualization, stereotyping? Cue signals. Is that a question? The clicker is not, I haven't put up a clicker yet, but there's a clicker coming. Yes. All right. So let's do a clicker then. So I'll start this multiple choice. Okay, so question is, for something to be called a signal, it must A, use sound, B, be visual, C, be beneficial to both sender and receiver, or C, communicate the location of an animal. What is a necessary condition to be called a signal? And we're not done yet. We still have to get to eavesdropping. But we're almost done. So we've got a large fraction of the class, not quite everybody yet. So almost everybody is getting it right. So I'll give you another 10 seconds. So get your answers in. Remember, they're graded just for completion, not correctness. Another 3 seconds. All right. Okay, so the answer I was looking for was C, must be beneficial to sender and receiver. When we design experiments, in order for us, if we test a hypothesis about signaling, we often are, it is up to us in the experiment to somehow show whether the presence of that signal is beneficial to both the sender and the receiver. So sometimes we have to design an experiment which maybe breaks the signal down, and then somehow we need to show that there's a proxy of fitness that is reduced in both those that were sending the signal and receiving the signal. So that's the kind of key thing. If somebody asks, is it a cue or a signal? What they're effectively asking to an animal behaviorist is, can you show whether there's benefit to both the sender and the receiver? If you can't, it's probably just a cue. Okay. All right. So, all right. So, this gets back to one of the questions that was asked earlier. When you're communicating in public, there's not just senders and receivers. There's third parties. So these are these Polistes fuscatus, this dark paper wasp. And so these paper wasps have, these are two females that, as you can see, are the same species, but have very different facial patterns. And there is a woman named Elizabeth Tibbetts, who's a professor at the University of Michigan. She'll actually be giving a talk here at ASU in mid-October at the Evolution of Social Complexity seminar on Wednesdays at noon. And so Liz Tibbetts is one of the ones who's been working in this system, using them as a model for so-called individual recognition. Because the crazy thing that these wasps do is that they have these diverse facial patterns, and they remember each other's facial patterns. And so she has gone through the effort to like paint the faces in different ways to test, you know, what things they're looking at and to sort of get them. And she'll find that the wasps will remember past interactions. And if they find the same facial pattern in the future, they will respond in a different way based on the past interaction with that facial pattern. So she's been manipulating with paint. Now, some of the work that I'm doing with her is actually try to use deep fake technology to create videos where we can move faces onto other wasps to test these sort of ideas. But so they're very good at, so basically, you know, this one is sending the signal of her face, and this receiver sees that signal, and this, they might potentially get into an aggressive interaction and fight. And if they fight, the outcome of that fight will be remembered by both of them. Yep. That's an interesting question. So the question was about, so, you know, there's certain parts of the vertebrate brain that remember faces. These invertebrates don't have the same brain structures. They don't have a hippocampus, but they have the same functions. We don't know. We know a lot of things about the structure of their brain, where certain things are stored and so on and so forth. But something like face memory, there are actually so few. This is like the only insect really that has been studied in terms of individual recognition and face memory. And so that question of where is it storing its face memory, it's probably in these so-called things called mushroom bodies, but to be able to sort of like, you know, ablate out the portion of the mushroom body that's you know, where faces are stored and then see what happens. That's something that would be a really cool experiment, but is beyond what we can do right now. Yeah. That's right. These are both females. So when we talk about Hymenoptera, wasps, ants, bees, we're almost never talking about the males because they're only around for mating. All right. So they communicate. They have this interaction. They remember the outcome of the interaction. So the next time they see each other, it affects their behaviors later. But there is a third wasp that is watching them. So Dr. Tibbetts can have a third wasp behind a plastic partition, watching two other wasps interact and fight and watching the outcome. And after that outcome, she can take the third wasp that's been behind that plastic partition and expose that wasp to the individuals that were involved in it. And she will respond differently to the loser versus the winner. So not only are they remembering their facial patterns, but she is eavesdropping and remembering the facial patterns of the winner and the loser and modifying her behaviors based on that interaction. So that's the downside of always displaying a signal, is that others, like, you know, if it didn't see this interaction, like if it saw the interaction and saw, wow, that one really is a very difficult, this is a tough wasp, I better not get into that. But if in this interaction, if this wasp aggressed and lost the fight, then this wasp gained information that, oh, actually, it's not as tough as it might have thought. Maybe if I want to get higher in the dominance hierarchy, I can pick a fight with that wasp and be lucky and be ready to win. Yeah. That's right. They're all females. So in these wasps, the males are only around for a very little amount of time. They're interesting. They're flying sperm. They only have their haploid. They live for a very short amount of time. They mate, and then these wasps, the rest of the society is just these females that are the diploid individuals. So yeah, these are all female wasps. Other questions about this eavesdropping? So this wasp will remember those two. So that opens up this liability of signaling in open space. And so we refer to this as public information. So signals are attributes that are available to generally any other animal in the environment. We refer to that as public information. And you can exploit that public information, and we refer to that as eavesdropping. So that's the term that when we talk about eavesdropping in animals, it's exploiting signals sent by a sender to another receiver, not you, and making use of that in some way that is good for you. Sometimes it's bad for the sender, but not always. And so an example here, sometimes this public information is a public good. So for example, it might be that a bird has, you know, sees a big predator and, you know, has an alarm call. And so this is, you know, this example down here, there are lizards that have ears that don't have any vocalizations. And like, well, why do the lizards have ears if they can't vocalize? Well, it turns out that they're very responsive to alarm calls of other birds. Now, those alarm calls from the other birds are for their conspecifics, they're for their family members, and so on and so forth, but it's in public information. It is not very costly for those birds to spread that public information, and that has been exploited by the lizards. Now, it's not any harm to the birds for the lizards to use that information, but it happens to be something that they have evolved to listen for these bird calls. So that's an example of, now in the human case, National Public Radio, for example, not everybody who listens to public radio actually donates to it. Those who donate receive a benefit from listening to it. Those who don't receive a benefit from listening to it. But it's a public good, so there's not a cost that is paid by the extra listeners, but the extra listeners get that benefit out, just like the lizard. So that's an example that not eavesdropping isn't always bad for the sender, but sometimes it's bad. And so when it's bad for the sender, then you see the evolution of concealment behaviors to try to maintain private information. So when personal information would be costly if a third party were to find it out, then you can see that an animal may be selected to conceal that information, ensuring the information stays private. So it's easier for me to list this with examples. So, for example, an animal that's foraging, this isn't even a communication example exact. I mean, it's giving cues off to one that could steal it. If an animal is foraging, they could forage in a very sort of inconspicuous way where it doesn't actually look like they're looking for food items. And they might, when they cache their food, they might have a way to sort of conceal that they're caching so that it just looks like they're maybe walking, for example. So that would be an example of a concealment behavior. A predator may hide while in pursuit of a prey. So the predator doesn't want to give off a signal of its presence to the prey. That would be eavesdropping by the prey. And so that would be something the predator would then conceal. An animal may only signal to another animal when in private. So they may actually try to only say, in the case of the male cricket I brought earlier, a male cricket has a very loud call, as you'll read about if you're in the perusal reading. That call is very noticeable to humans. And so that cricket wants to only call when it's in the presence of other female crickets and possibly male crickets, depending on sort of complexities there, but it wants to be in the presence of other crickets. If it senses that it's in the presence of crickets and potential predators, it will stop its call immediately. And it's got these little cirrhi on the back end that make them very sensitive. It can tell air currents and things like that. And so that's a way that it can stop its call and then jump away. So that's an example of concealment where, in this case, the signal is very, very important. It's a sexual signal, it needs it to mate, but it is very, very costly, because it also brings potential predators to that location. So in that case, it's evolved concealment. So concealment, private information. And so all of this stuff together adds a layer of complexity. So we can kind of summarize this whole thing in sort of this diagram that, we've got senders, we've got intended receivers, we've got unintended receivers. Those unintended receivers benefit from public information. In order to sort of keep information from being public, we have concealed information in private channels. We start the whole process of signaling off with non-signal information cues that have some unintended value to a receiver. And over time, they evolve into signals, which are a co-evolved trait between senders and receivers that provide benefit to both. So in the end, you look at all of these tensions pulling together, and we see that communication is a very complicated thing, which is why it is a major target for research. So it's a really rich area of animal behavior, is studying how animals deal with all of these conflicts. How do they get information where it needs to be and keep it from getting to another source where it shouldn't be? And that's basically that. So any questions about these the last parts here? Concealment, eavesdropping, public information. Yeah.
And then at the end of this, you get what the center is.
Well, if it's just information value, then we just refer to it as a cue. So and so there, as we'll talk, we will have a more interesting answer to that on Tuesday of next week when we talk about deceit and those sorts of things. But for now, we'll just call those cues. Okay. Well, Matt, then let's close here with this question. I'll start this short answer? So, question here is, what is it called? I'm looking for one word. When information broadcasted by a sender is exploited by an unintended receiver. What is our name for that in animal behavior? And that's all I've got for you. So once you answer that, feel free to head out and we'll see you Thursday for modes of communication.